So we're sitting here in one of the production offices for Deadwood with its creator, David Milch. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
This season, you have focused on a lot of different issues, addiction being one of them, but also race. And how did you decide to integrate a series of several strong black characters into your show?
I guess I'd have to say I didn't make the decision on that basis. The character of Aunt Lou Marchbanks, who is the character that was, who's the African American character was brought on this year, was actually in the camp from the first, which is to say from April of 1876. And it was a decision to exclude her in the first season because I felt that she was not representative of, if one were to have only one African-American character and she was a cook, I felt that it would force us into a very limited range of behavior. So there was another character who came to the camp in the second season. Both of these, as I say, real people, whose name was Samuel Fields, who advertised himself in the camp directory as a cosmopolite, which I think it meant he carried messages between guys who were cheating and prostitutes, who called himself the Nigger General. And once he had been established, I felt then he and another character, Hostetler, had been established, then I felt that we could broaden out and introduce the character of Aunt Lou, who became a fixture in Deadwood and, in fact, went on and operated her own hotel and prospered.
One thing that I found remarkable is that this is based on true events. I had no idea when I was watching the show. Tell us how you came about these characters, this story, this town.
Well, some of them, as I say, are have a historical basis, and some of them are the products of imagination. As I say, Samuel Fields, the Nigger General, who's a bit of a hustler, was well known in Deadwood. Hostetler was a product of my imagination and very much influenced. They say, you know, if you're going to steal from the best. There was a character in a novel by William Faulkner called Intruder in the Dust, whose name was, I believe, Beecham, Lucas Beecham. He was a character of such pride and such dignity who insisted upon a position in the community, which was whatever history said about his position as a black man, he was going to determine the terms upon which he would be taken. And you pay an enormous price for that kind of pride. And in the Faulkner novel, because the character was relegated to a secondary status, I had always wanted to do more with a character like that. And Hostetler is such a character, and the very thing which allows him to live, which is his pride and his insistence on being treated as a man rather than as a black man, is the thing finally that kills him. The tragic paradox, I think, for many African Americans is it lies exactly in that doubleness, that because of the historical moment in which they find themselves, the things that they must do to affirm their humanity often end in costing them their lives.
You know, Faulkner said that the past isn't even past. So
yeah.
Are you directly drawing allegories to today's America? Indirectly? Does it matter to you whether or not this resonates with modern human nature?
Well, if we agree with Faulkner that the past isn't even past, it doesn't really matter what I think. Those resonances will exist whether or not they're intentional. And as a storyteller, I try not to think allegorically. You know, I think the way a symbol or generates its meaning is by the story's insistence on its not being symbolic. And if you just stay with the obstinate finality of the character or the moment, whatever symbolic meaning that moment and that character begin to generate is part of a separate process and transaction that goes on between the viewer and the character.
Since some of these characters are based on real people, I believe Hearst and Swearingen, who are two enemies at this point, are based on real people. Have you ever heard from the estates of anyone saying, "You are an awful man for defaming my great-great-grandfather, and how could you?"
Well, you seem to be in formulating your question, suggesting that the Hearst family might have been in touch, and I would have to say that our paths have crossed, but in relatively speaking a civil fashion. Obviously, you know, if it was my great-grandfather being talked about, I wouldn't be too thrilled about it either. But I find Hearst a fascinating personality, and as I did Swearingen, as I did Bullock.
So Hearst, just for people who haven't seen the show, Hearst is a real balls of steel kind of guy, as is Swearingen. And then Bullock, the sheriff, tries to mediate and keep some modicum of peace, although he has his own demons.
He has his own demons, and all of those were historical figures. George Hearst was the father of William Randolph Hearst, about whom it is said the film Citizen Kane was done. And Hearst made his first $50 million or so in the California gold rush, but it was the Deadwood claim, which just goes to show you how relative things are, which really made his fortune. And he was a great believer in the kind of the virtues of consolidation and monopoly, and he was a man who was not averse to what others might take to be ruthless business methods. And that's all pretty well documented and really not even much apologized for by the Hearsts of that time. Hearst himself wrote an autobiographical fragment which was pretty candid in acknowledging some of those things. And he, notwithstanding all of them, went on to become a senator from California, so I guess he couldn't have been all bad, huh?
If you say so. So how do you develop the language for this show? Because one of the things that has been most talked about this show is the refinement of the cadence of the language and the absolute vulgarity of the words.
Yeah.
The F word gets thrown around like, you know, cookie crumbs at a child's birthday party. And
you should be a writer yourself.
I am, actually.
Well, good.
But the cadences are very Shakespearean. How did you come up with that mix?
Well, in the same way when we were talking about symbolism a moment ago, I think I just try and stay on the surface of things. And my experience and all the research that I did was that the language of that time in mining camps in particular was profoundly and incessantly obscene. And the reason for that was that these were people who were living not even on the margins of society, but outside of the margins of society. And one way that you let people know, one way you can get through the day without having to do violence is by having recourse to a language which is soaked in violence. And it's kind of like apes beating on their chest, I suppose. And so by every account, and you know, one went to the Library of Congress and the Oral History Project, and if you look at H.L. Mencken's book, The American Language, Daniel Boorstin's book, everyone points to the mining camps as cesspools of verbal obscenity. So the other thing was that to the extent that people read, they read Shakespeare and they read the Romantics, the Romantic novelists or the Victorian novelists, and they read the Bible. And so those who were lettered, their language had Shakespearean echoes and Elizabethan echoes, as you know, the St. James Bible was a product of Elizabethan times, so I made no conscious decisions. I just try to imagine. I try to actually listen to my characters talk, and that's the way they were talking.
Tell me what you mean by that, because a lot of writers say that they hear their characters talking to them.
Well,
how do you first come up with the inspiration for a character and then find that voice?
Well, I tried to read everything that I could, and then you decide what of what you've read is true and why you tend to doubt what you do doubt, and finally you kind of try to let the characters walk past the written accounts of their lives into your imagination, and at that point you try and forget your research. And I don't have that consistent a hold on reality anyway. So I mean, I hear voices all the time. I'm just lucky enough to get paid for it about half the time, so that's what I did. You know, you as a writer yourself, then I'm sure you understand that you do your research, and then at a certain point you got to forget it and let it reconfigure itself in your own imagination.
What is going to happen? I don't mean literally to the characters, although we are sitting in a room with mock-up boards, and I'm trying not to look at them because I don't want to know what happens next. What is going to happen to the conclusion of this show? How is it going to be played out in terms of the series pacing and these, I understand, possible movies that will...
Yeah, the idea today, what time is it? The idea today at about 12:20 is that there will be two 2-hour films after the third season completes its run. We've shot the episodes for the third season. That's a different kind of storytelling. You know, with the 12 episodes a season, I was kind of trying to take a day in the life of the camp for each episode. The two 2-hour films will work with a different idea of time, dramatizing larger portions of the camp's experience in each of those episodes. And it's an interesting prospect for me. I haven't lived into it in its particularity as yet, but I very much look forward to doing it. And I have tried as I get older, and I am by now very old,
I kind of doubt that looking at you.
Well, there's some city miles on these treads, but I've tried never to think very far ahead in terms of how the work is going to go. So the fact that there were these changes in plans, I had a general idea of the story that I wanted to tell, and I see no reason why that story can't be told in this modified framework. The kind of scale of detail and the pace is going to be different, but you know, I'm grateful for the opportunity that I've had to tell the story of Deadwood, and I look forward to the way we're going to conclude it. I don't know. I'm going to let it talk to me when the time comes, and so I can't really be responsible in suggesting how I'm going to finish the story, but as we've been discussing, so many of the characters were real, and I certainly am not going to betray any of that. I'm not going to go against any of that stuff. So,
do you consider that a restriction or
no?
A
that's a blessing and a liberation, because the facts themselves are simply ways for the past to speak to us in code. You know, there's the historical fact and the so-called historical fact, and then the very fact or the very reality. And I'm at liberty in that regard. And as a storyteller, that's what you want.
You've got another project coming up. Joe from Cincinnati, is that the
John?
John from Cincinnati, sorry.
That may be better, Joe from Cincinnati.
Okay, if I see that.
You better arbitrate for a little bit.
So, John from Cincinnati, what's that about? Because I understand it's very different from Deadwood.
Yeah, it's pretty different. It's a contemporary story, and it's about a surfing community in a very sort of dissolute and desperate part of America, which is Imperial Beach, pretty near the border with Mexico. And I wish I knew a little better what it was about.
Joe's not talking yet?
John.
Oh, John, sorry.
You know, I'm going to call him Joe and see if he doesn't become more loquacious.
I think that's a good idea.
Okay, that's your idea.
Before we let you go, just a couple things struck me from the show. One is when Hurst talks about the color. He's talking to his cook's son, who has just returned from Liberia, who is this ambitious, canny person, the young man, but I don't know whether he can go toe-to-toe with Hurst. Mm-hmm. So Hurst mentions the color. The young man gets offended. He thinks he's talking about race, and Hurst is talking about gold as this almost Greek ideal, the color that makes the world go round.
Yeah.
What inspired you to have money and commerce become almost a character in and of itself?
Well, I'm not. There's no reason why you would know this, but I had originally proposed this series to HBO as a series about Rome at the time immediately after Christ's crucifixion. What interested me was how a symbol, in that instance it would have been the cross, came to organize human behavior. And symbols, to me, are significant as illusions agreed upon. In other words, the symbolism, there's nothing inherent in a cross that suggests the experience of Christ any more than there is anything intrinsic in gold which speaks of value. Gold has no value except as we agree upon its meaning. And what Hurst, in his sort of perverted messianic vision of what gold can accomplish, is suggesting that to the extent we can agree upon the value of a symbol, we can trump any sort of prejudice, that a white might have for a black, to the extent that we can agree upon the meaning of this symbol, we can transcend that. Now, that, in fact, is errant nonsense, although it's a lovely thought. And in the idea of most theories, it's self-serving. It allows us to explore. I think that symbols liberate, the agreement upon certain symbols liberate a tremendous amount of organizational energy in humans. The car as a status symbol got a lot of people to work in the 1920s, you know, and yet in the context of a relationship between Hurst, who was really an oppressive personality, and a young aspiring African American, it seemed to me it was a conversation shot through with ironies and ambiguities, and those are the kind of talks I like.
Yeah. I guess finally, David, take me back in time to a moment when you felt you were a writer for the first time, and what being a writer means to you.
Well, I can answer the second part first. For me, being a writer is a bridge to the world, and without that bridge, I'd be lost. And as to when I guess I first recognized that, my best friend was, we were both drunks, and he was killed in a car wreck, I think, when we were 16, I felt such a tearing, such a disjunction between what I had thought or hoped the world was like and the world's reality, and I found that in writing about him and in his about his family and so on, that there was a kind of healing which was available, not by creating an alternative reality, but simply in testifying to life's complexity and sadness and its beauty, and whether or not we want to accept it, I guess that kind of has to be enough. And I was very lucky to find it. I had a lot of opportunities to go in a lot of other directions, and being able to pursue this one was a blessing.
Well, David Milch, thank you.
My pleasure.